You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Pretty good.
It's kind of slow.
What's slow? The flow slow?
No, the beat slow.
It's minimal. There's a difference. It's not overpowering a rhyme.
Sounds like a conversation I had recently about Pete's Dragon.
Hey, there is a fine line between slow and minimal. Greg Robinson there with newcomer Marquise Christmas in Morris from America, a hit at Sundance earlier this year, just getting a limited release here in Chicago and elsewhere. We've got a review of the Germany set Fish Out of Water story, plus thoughts on a few more recent releases. That and much more.
Credit to Elliot the Dragon. He does have sick flow.
Ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is once again supported by Film Spotting listeners, including Jacob in Vista, California.
This donation is for mentioning the man who shot Liberty Valance. Loved the conversation with Klosterman. But I need to point out that Star Trek has been predicting a future with the internet for decades. We may not have warp drives or transporter beams, but we sure do carry around and even wear devices that can access any information at any time.
Well played, Jacob. New Silver Club donors Gabriel in South San Francisco and Damien from Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Sorry for your loss, Damien. We do wish you all the best. We also have a new $5 a month subscriber, Frank in Martinez, California, and a gold-level donor right here in Chicago, Fern.
Why donate? Fern asks. One, in normal conversation, I frequently make mention of something I've heard on Film Spotting and its family of podcasts. Two, my to-watch list is filled with movies I've heard about through you. Oh, how my boyfriend suffers over watching yet another Film Spotting recommendation. And three, I have received endless hours of entertainment and information from listening and getting to know you. It's time. Thank you.
Film Spotting. It'll make your better half suffer. A new platinum level donor. Thank you so much, Mitchell in Gainesville, Florida. And we don't even have a name for this one, Josh. Super Platinum?
I was going to say, this is the first I've seen this.
I don't know what to call it because I think it's the first we've seen this generous of a donation, or certainly close. Rob Smith in Kansas City says, happy 600 Film Spotting.
I came across Cinecast in 2005 looking for a Batman Begins review. I am also a film-loving Hawkeye and really love the interaction between Adam and Sam. I've been a loyal listener since and even have my own Sam nickname, Carnage Killer. It's funny, though. The memorable moments for me are more personal. I remember Sam and Adam's voices catching as they prepared to talk about the brilliant but grueling grave of the Fireflies. I remember Adam asking, "You're really doing this?" when Sam added the van when he and Carrie got married. I remember rooting for Sam as he and I were both training for our first marathons at the same time. I'm sending a long overdue donation to hopefully help keep this train moving. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much, Rob. Thank you to all of our generous donors this week and all of our recurring monthly subscribers. You do help keep us doing what we're doing. You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. If we sound a little low on energy, it's because we are still recovering from last week's big 600th episode with Chuck Klosterman and the top five movies historians of the future will remember. It took a lot out of us, Josh, but there's been a great response to it so far. We may get to some of those responses on an upcoming show. Of course, we want to say thanks again to Chuck for making that show a special one. We actually realized too late that we probably should have given ourselves a little bit of a break after that one.
Would have been nice.
Tried to recharge the batteries a little bit, but we can promise you we will not phone it in tonight, even though we are going to have some critics phone in. So that is coming a bit later in the show. I'm going to have some help as I share thoughts on some recent releases like Don't Breathe, Little Men, and the Obama first date movie, South Side with You. We will also spend a moment or two reflecting on the late, great Gene Wilder.
Look at you, so busy. How'd you fit all that in?
I had an afternoon open, no kids, no wife around. I just had 4 hours to kill. I went to the multiplex, saw two movies.
Nice.
Yeah.
You're making me look like a slacker.
That's my goal.
I've been writing away. I have no time for the book revision is due in a few weeks.
Excuse.
And so no movies, no sleep for me, at least till we get to October.
All right, I'll buy it.
Before we get to all that, Morris from America has been warming hearts since debuting at Sundance earlier this year, which begs the question, just how cold is mine?
You feel me?
It's got no hook.
Get out of here with that no hook shit. This ain't pop. It's music right here, boy.
It's boring.
But go to your room. You're grounded.
For what?
Because you like terrible music.
Can't ground me for that.
I can't? So you make the rules now? Is that what I'm hearing? Stop making them noises with your mouth. What is that? Oh, okay. You know what? I can't hear it because it's sick as me. Tell me you can't dance to that.
You definitely can't dance to this.
A clip there from the opening scene of Morris from America, picking up actually right where we left off at the start of the show. Craig Robinson's Curtis Gentry partaking in an activity I think all fathers dream about. I know I did. Sitting your perfect son or daughter down and guiding them along the path toward the perfect taste in music. Or maybe it's movies or books or, I don't know, passing on your love of kites. Whatever it is, we can't wait to share our appreciation for something with our children and have them appreciate it back. When we meet 13-year-old Morris, played by Marquise Christmas, Curtis's plan seems to be succeeding. Smile on his face, head bobbing in rhythm, and then it's kind of slow. It's got no hook. Sadly, everything about that scene felt familiar to me, right down to the child's crushing refusal to submit to his parents' will. In fact, a lot of Morris from America, writer-director Chad Hartigan's third feature and the follow-up to 2013's well-reviewed This Is Martin Bonner, feels familiar. Young African-American teen, struggling to adjust to a new environment, Heidelberg, Germany. Okay, maybe that part doesn't feel familiar. And as A.A. Dowd notes in his positive AV Club review, the fish-out-of-water angle helps, because if you're going to tell a coming-of-age story about a kid with a tough love father, a dead mother, and a hopeless crush on the coolest girl in town, you're going to need all the unique perspective you can muster. So setting aside, there's perhaps very little new or surprising about Morris from America. Dramatically and comedically, it's steady, not stunning. Some might even say, kind of slow. None of which is to say it isn't satisfying. Josh, how's this going to go? Is this review going to be one of those special bonding moments between us? Or are you definitely getting sent to your room?
No bonding here. And it gives me no pleasure to say that, not because it's always more fun to enjoy a movie together, but because this is one that I was looking forward to for quite a long time. The idea sounded great. Hartigan is a filmmaker I am unfamiliar with, but as well heard great things about This Is Martin Bonner. Meant to catch up with that before seeing this and wasn't able to. So I was going in fully expecting an enjoyable experience. And there are certainly moments in it that work that way for me. We'll get to some of those. But just to jump off of some of the things you said there, in terms of the effort to make this fish out of water coming of age story new by setting it in Heidelberg, Germany, I wonder if in seeking the newness, it lost something in authenticity, something where the familiarity we might have from a setting that is more not generic, but just more familiar might have given us that authentic sense. Because, boy, you said it felt familiar. Very little in this, I don't want to say familiar, because I'm not looking for my story to be reflected, but this had the overall feeling of being a construct that was imposed on inauthentic characters.
Wow.
And what I want to feel when I go to a film like this is something that's organic, a narrative that's attuned, deeply attuned to what is happening in the story. And I just never felt that here. I couldn't convince myself of it. There are a few moments that Robinson manages to nail and Hartigan draws out of him that do have that in terms of the parenting aspect that you're talking about. I think that soliloquy he has at the end is just beautiful, beautifully delivered, shot in a mostly long take. And I think it also stood out for me to be what was missing from most of the movie. Here's just a tiny detail that is not wholly representative, but somewhat representative of what I'm talking about. I didn't believe a room that these characters were in a place that we're supposed to feel as a new and intriguing setting. I didn't, except for when they're walking down the streets, I had no sense that they were in Germany. From their apartment, from the youth center that he visits, they could have not only been taking place almost anywhere in America, mm-hmm. but on a stage in America. It was just one emblem of a falseness for me that I felt that kind of carried out through most of the film.
You're definitely grounded. Sorry, because everything...
What does film spotting grounding involve, by the way?
That's a good question. It actually sounds like a reprieve. You might look forward to that.
And is there a window to the roof of the garage so I can hop out and get away?
Right. Everything you just articulated that you wanted from this movie or this type of movie is pretty much exactly what I experienced. And it's funny you bring that up, the setting, as a negative, because I really did make a note of that as a strength of the movie. I loved the fact that from very early in the film... If I didn't know going in that the movie was set in Germany, it took me a good 15 or 20 minutes to realize that. And
well,
the reason
used,
I like
that's
that.
That's used as a joke at the very beginning, which I liked. We're supposed to assume we're in an American city where a story like this would take place.
But
and
I
then
think,
they're out eating ice cream, walking down the Heidelberg streets. And you're like, whoa, what's going on
So
here?
It's a little bit of a joke.
That was good.
I think for me, though, it's not just about the humor. It's about grounding this in a way that makes it universal. It really could be happening back in New York.
Generic or universal?
No, not generic, because there's so many things that happen here that are very specific and very honest. And that's the thing for me. That opening scene is just one example I related to. And I say related to because, like you, it doesn't mean I have to think about it as a father. The father's not the main character here. I related to the kid. I found lots of ways into this movie. I related to his German instructor. There were a lot of issues being discussed and issues being dealt with that just rang true for me, and it felt always honest. This movie for me is a golden brick contender, and I think that the key is that, like a lot of great coming-of-age stories, this movie fundamentally is about phoniness, but always felt authentic. So again, we saw a very different movie or heard a very different beat with this film, but if you think about some of the dialogue and a bit of the plot of this movie, there's a bit where Morris listens to a tape of his father rapping back in the day, and he realizes, well, he's not spitting his own rhymes, it's just Biggie. Of course, that makes his father to him seem like a phony. Even he, as a kid, is writing rhymes that don't at all reflect who he is, and later his father acknowledges that he doesn't mind that he's writing these really vulgar, explicit lyrics. He minds that he's writing explicit lyrics that aren't also honest.
Robinson is so good in that
scene. He's so good. And then the counselor, just one more example, the counselor at this youth center gets up there and talks as if he's got these great ambitions and he's going to unite all of them and give them some amazing life-changing activities, but he doesn't follow through on any of them, and he certainly doesn't have the open-minded ideals that he pretends to have. So I just felt that this movie, again, going back to whether it's Catcher in the Rye or lots of other great coming-of-age stories, whether it's novels or film, we've seen this emphasis on phoniness, on trying to strive for something authentic. And then in this case, I think it really does pull off being authentic. And one of those reasons, Josh, is because I did keep waiting, maybe because of the familiarity, maybe because we've seen so many movies similar to this. I kept waiting for the big event to happen. Something was going to go really wrong. Something else sort of tragic to help put life in some grand perspective. And Hartigan never succumbs to it. I think what we see with Morris is he just makes mistakes, and his dad makes mistakes, and his German instructor even makes mistakes, and they try to then, the adults try to use those mistakes to teach him and to protect him, but that's all they add up to be are mistakes, not these necessarily grand life-changing events. And not only does Hartigan manage to avoid those kind of storytelling cliches in terms of giving us an emotional payoff, in the sequence where any other conventional coming-of-age movie would have played a breakthrough moment as this major breakthrough, really triumphantly, Hartigan, wisely, I think, downplays it. It's a nice moment, but it's not a movie moment. It marks an important step for Morris to take, but it's not the culmination of anything. It's just a step.
The concert scene,
yep.
Are you talking about?
Yeah.
See, that one completely didn't work for me. And the production design was a huge fact of that. You've got, these are details you would have to have seen it, but you've got the girl that Morris is pining after standing to the side. And it's like, I never believed they were even in a club there. There was just something off about that. But you're right. There are no big moments, big emotional moments here. But this is not, there isn't low-key realism really going on as well. I mean, it hits a lot of cliches. That counselor you mentioned, the scene where he accuses Morris of smoking marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
We also have that same girl.
I don't think that's a cliche.
Who,
that felt right to me. That felt right.
The same girl setting the trap for him early on. The bullies overall that he faces. I mean, this is all conventional, familiar stuff that I didn't feel was given much of a twist at all.
Why does it have to have a twist, though? I mean,
because it's not that interesting.
There's
an airlessness to it. If there's no twist or even a low key realism where you know you're watching actual life that doesn't need to have pumped up drama.
There isn't pumped up drama here.
That sort of stuff. No, but there is convention and there is cliche without much authenticity.
Convention is convention for a reason. It's often very effective. It's what it does within those conventions to exude honesty. I certainly felt it here.
I want to give more credit to Robinson because he comes close to saving the movie for me, actually. And the two scenes we've talked about so far are excellent ones. And I also like the one where he's on his own. Morris is out of the house and he discovers this porn magazine that Morris has been hiding in his room. And he just sort of sits with that reality for a while, that this is something now new he has to deal with as a single parent. And the lovely touch of him deciding to call the sex line on the back looking for companionship.
Of course.
And how that plays out and the way Robinson plays it, which probably shouldn't even give it away because it could go in so many directions. And I just love the way that they take it and, again, the tone that Robinson hits there.
I'm with you completely on Robinson, though I wouldn't say he's better than the movie. I think what he pulls off here and the line he straddles actually is the line that the movie ultimately straddles. He's really, really good. There's a way he delivers a funny line, and I don't mean a single line. He has lots of funny lines that's neither deadpan nor menacing, but it's also not jokey or jovial.
Yeah.
It's just real. He's an actor, and in this case, he's a character who's just naturally funny.
Yes.
And
that
comes through. He does not have to exert himself at all.
He's not selling jokes. He's playing a funny guy.
Exactly. And I want so badly to play a certain clip from this movie. And the only reason I would even say that, Josh, I'm not going to because I don't want to spoil it, but A24 put this great bit out on the internet as one of the clips from the movie. So they're not trying to hide anything or avoid any spoilers. There is an end conversation, mainly a monologue that happens between father and son, where he's phenomenal. Everything about
the
delivery, yeah. And not just him, but the way Christmas acts opposite him in that scene, everything about how that is handled, shot, acted, you name it, I think is perfect. And I think throughout, Marquise Christmas is a great foil to Robinson, where he's always giving back as good as he gets, but not in any kind of rebellious way. It's just in the way that he clearly has that sort of dynamic with his dad. And as I mentioned, moments that feel honest, whether I directly relate to them or not, I love the touch where he wakes up, the father, and his son's already up and he's eating cereal and he's like, what are we going to do today?
Yeah,
and he keeps asking them these questions about what they're going to do today. It takes him about 5 minutes to realize that his son has plans that don't include him. And instead of that being this emotional kind of after school special kind of moment where the dad has to wrestle with the fact that his son is growing up and moving on without him, he understands that that's part of life and he's actually happy for his son. But that realization that they're not really best friends or they're not going to be best friends, that's not the dynamic that's going to continue, that's really touching, again, in a way that isn't played for any kind of emotion at all.
Yeah, the father's loneliness is probably one of the more authentic elements to me. I want to ask you about another aspect of the movie and see how it played for you. And that was these moments of I guess you could call them magical realist flashes, and there are only a handful of them. The one example comes early on when Morris stops at a museum and he's got his earbuds in. So we hear his music and he's looking around and suddenly the other patrons start bopping their heads to his beat. And then it goes a step further where a statue's head actually starts bopping, and then the figures in a stained glass window start doing it as well. That's about the most extreme example, but there are also little flashes where we're maybe getting inside of Morris's head, but it's not always exactly clear. And again, they happen very sporadically. There might be three or four at the most overall in the whole film. How did you take those?
Well, they didn't bother me, obviously, or they didn't derail anything. But thinking about that scene in particular in the museum, I'd actually completely forgotten it until you brought it up. It is this moment of magical realism that I don't think adds anything. Ultimately, maybe if it somehow was a more consistent motif throughout the film, or I felt like they were really adding some insight into his character and his psyche, then I would have been a little bit more interested in those scenes or had a stronger reaction to them. I suppose you could argue that Hartigan is probably trying to show us a moment when he actually does feel at ease in this environment, maybe for the first time. But again, it's not any kind of line that's ever followed through in the rest of the film, I felt.
Yeah, well, maybe listeners will have, an idea of how that was carried through. And maybe we can talk about some of the other examples that happened later in the film, too. But, overall, this is one of those absolutely people should see, because I am very much in the minority on this. And I can see that the elements you're talking about, I don't know that it's taste or that it's tone, but it is one of those things that the movie's trying to ring a bell, right? A bell of authenticity. And for most people, obviously, the tone is just right. And I'm just hearing something a little differently.
Authenticity has to be organic or it's not authentic. And I didn't feel like it was going for that in the same way you did. Morris from America is currently playing in limited release. It's also available via cable on demand and for rent on most digital platforms. So lots of ways to see this film if you're not one who gets out to the theater that often. And if you do get a chance to check it out, we'd love to know what you thought, whether you agree or disagree with our takes. You can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. And speaking, Josh, of things on digital platforms, Film Spotting SVU with Matt Singer and Allison Wilmore. It's our biweekly podcast devoted to all things streaming. They just had a new episode drop that has their review of the 2016 documentary Wiener.
How about that?
About disgraced politician Anthony Wiener. And Allison pointed out on Twitter, this movie became dated literally as they were recording it over the weekend. That's when the latest scandal broke. They were already into the episode. I don't think they were aware of it during the episode until after.
No, it doesn't sound like
that. Yeah, it was happening as they were taping.
Listen to it today. I mean, how crazy that we all have things we're struggling with, but this is just spectacular, isn't it?
Yeah,
I don't know.
It really is. You can find that show in iTunes. Just do a search for Film Spotting SVU. SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on Cable, the art house in your house. Learn more at rentmoviesondemand.com.
That makes me wonder, Carlos Danger, that Wiener was that a Sam Van Halgren nickname?
It should have been.
It sounds like it could be. All right, enough silliness. Our poll question about your most anticipated fall movies is up next. We're going to have the results and a whole bunch more. Stay with us. I've seen you on the silver screen, and I've seen you in the tight star. I see you everywhere I go, and I see you in my dreams. And then I see you shopping through your wall, and I see you holding your shot, and I see you everywhere I go. And I see you, and I see you.
What's your name?
Well, my name is Jim, but most people call me Jim.
Okay, Jim, since you are my guest and I am your host, what are your pleasures? What do you like to do?
Oh, I don't know. Play chess? Screw.
Well, let's play chess.
The late Gene Wilder with Cleavon Little and Mel Brooks's Blazing Saddles, a former Sacred Cow review here on Film Spotting. Wilder passed away this past Monday due to complications from Alzheimer's. He was 83. And certainly, if we are putting together the pantheon of all-time great comedic screen actors, Wilder has to be somewhere near the top of the list, if not at the top of it. And actually, I referenced this during our 600th episode. On our 100th show, we shared our top five male and female favorite performances, comedic and dramatic. Mm-hmm. And I had a top five that didn't include Wilder, but you know, Josh, as I sometimes want to do, that's only because I set him aside in the pantheon for his performance as Willy Wonka. I just thought it was too obvious. Otherwise, it would have been my number one.
And I completely understand that. He's absolutely at the top of my list. If I were going to go ahead and make that, it was really weird getting this news because I'm not one who usually has emotional responses to actors or filmmakers when they pass away, but I think it's because I associate Wilder so much with my childhood in performances like Wonka, but also, you know, even stuff like Silver Streak or some of these movies, Stir Crazy, that I saw on television, you know, that was playing on WGN. And I think for me, part of what it was is he was one of my first tastes of adult comedy. And, you know, by adult, I don't mean like risque, but more like risky. Mm-hmm. He was a performer who was risky. He was unhinged. He was unpredictable. And, you know, that's different than maybe Sesame Street or wherever else I was getting my jokes from, the Muppets or, this was a guy who was just making me laugh in new ways.
Yeah. His unpredictability, that's a great way to put it. And I was just reminded about this when I got an email. I had completely forgotten that he was actually a University of Iowa graduate. So Gene Wilder, a Hawkeye. I had to note that. But in an article about Wilder passing in the Daily Iowan, they quoted him as talking about the impact Charlie Chaplin's City Lights had on him. He said, "What made the biggest impression on me as an actor, it was funny, then sad, then both at the same time." Hmm. And being able to capture those multitudes of emotions at once, I feel like, is what Wilder really excelled in.
He did, and yet I feel like he never got the chance to really push that and explore it in a way like,
true,
say, maybe like Bill Murray has been able to do in his second act. And I always felt that Wilder had that in him, just didn't get the material. Mm-hmm.
Back in February 2014, as I mentioned, that's when we did our Sacred Cow review of Blazing Saddles in honor of its 40th anniversary. I don't know how much of that discussion time we devoted to Wilder, but I'm guessing he did get some due.
I'm sure he came up.
He had to. That's in our archives. It's episode 479. Next week, we were thinking that this little bit of tribute really isn't enough. It would be a good time to revisit Mel Brooks's other landmark comedy from 1974, the movie I put, I believe, at number five as my top five movies to show your kids.
That's
non-kids
right.
Movies to show your kids. And we're both going to get the chance to do that this weekend because we're going to talk about Young Frankenstein.
Frankenstein.
Of course, Frankenstein from 1974. And if you want to dive in a little bit and learn more about Wilder's career, we do recommend Charles Bromesco's Gene Wilder's 10 Greatest Performances article he wrote for Rolling Stone Online. So he goes through some of the ones you mentioned, Josh, like Silver Streak and Stir Crazy, of course, Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, Willy Wonka, The Producers, everything you ever wanted to know about sex but were afraid to ask. That bit with the sheep truly is comic brilliance. And to your point, Josh, about not really having a second act, he did some TV in the early 2000s. He appeared on Will and Grace, but otherwise hadn't really done a movie of note since the late 80s, early 90s. It's unfortunate that as he got older, we didn't get a chance to see him more on screen. But again, we're going to pay tribute to him in more detail next week with that Sacred Cow review. And inspired a bit by Gene Wilder, we're going to share our top five 21st century comedies, also inspired by the BBC list that recently came out of the top 100 movies since 2000. There was an article in Vulture lamenting how there were no real pure comedies on that list. So we're going to try to rectify that a little bit with our list.
That's going to be fun. We should also note that the Music Box Theater here in Chicago, in honor of Wilder, they're going to do this on Tuesday the 13th, present 35mm prints of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory and Blazing Saddles. Wonka's at 7. It's 9:15 for Saddles. Two great movies to see with a crowd.
For sure. We will link to more information about that in our show notes at filmspotting.net. And we did want to take a second to thank our listeners who came out to a little impromptu, and it really was, because other than mentioning it on Twitter like the day before and on the show that came out the day before, we didn't otherwise publicize this meetup. But we had a listener who we've mentioned on the show, Rich, not from Austin, but from Denton, Texas, who came all the way out to Chicago to see us do our show live. Well, also to go on a bunch of brewery tours. And yeah, he did that.
He was busy.
Yeah, he had fun despite the fact that we pulled the rug out from under him. But he came all the way out here because we were going to have a live show for our 600th episode on August 27th. That has since been pushed back to November. And we'll talk about that more in the coming weeks, though some of the details about the Chicago Podcast Festival are already out there, including the dates. We told Rich that to make it up to him, that we would definitely get together with him. And turns out Michael Phillips and his wonderful wife, Heidi, showed up
for
a time.
Met yet, so
yeah,
that was nice.
I had only met Heidi once, and we thought that there might be more hosts at this than listeners.
Which would have been okay.
Which would have been fine, too. We would have enjoyed hanging out and having a few drinks. But not only was Rich there, Simon made the trip from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
How about that?
Dave Coletta here in Chicago. Melissa from here in Chicago as well. Of course, our wives had to suffer through a little bit of film spotting talk
as well.
We
got some dinner beforehand.
That's
so
true.
It was worth it for them. Thank you so much to everyone who came out. It was a fun night.
How's it going?
Honey, show daddy.
Not done.
You did such a good job.
It's showtime. You can use your props.
My dad is Mike. He works on a drilling rig that pumps oil out from underneath the ocean.
We're the explorers.
Like Dora.
Like Dora.
Mark Wahlberg in the trailer for Deepwater Horizon, one of several real-life tales making their way to the big screen this fall. Last week and all the hoopla of the 600th show, we managed to completely skip what we had expected to do, which was our poll results. We're going to get to those now, though, Josh, nobody seemed to notice.
Maybe it's because we put something like Deepwater Horizon on the poll.
Maybe so. They had already just completely written off this poll before we even bothered to get to the results. We're going to do that now. A couple weeks back, we did our version of a fall movie preview. We shared our top five questions about the fall movie season. Our deeply flawed fall movie-related poll question was, what's your most anticipated fall 2016 movie that's based on a true story? And we gave these to you in release order. And we say deeply flawed because we acknowledge again that Loving certainly should have been in this poll, the upcoming Jeff Nichols movie. And this first option probably shouldn't have been. It's Southside with You. A little bit more on that later in this segment. Michelle and Barack Obama's first date came out here at the end of August. Not really a fall movie, but Josh, we did list it as an option along with Sully, the new Clint Eastwood movie with Tom Hanks opening September 9th, Snowden, Oliver Stone's latest film with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, that's September 16th, The Birth of a Nation, Nate Parker, his story of Nat Turner coming out October 7th, and finally, Deepwater Horizon, Peter Berg directing Mark Wahlberg. Again, it comes out October 30th, and that one, not surprisingly, didn't fare too well against these options.
No, deservedly in last place, 4%. That was followed by Southside with You, which received 7% of the vote. Sully received 11%. Snowden received 23%. And taking it pretty handily, The
yeah.
Birth of a Nation with 55%.
So our frequent commenter here, Billy Ray Bruton in L.A. writes, this might be the least excited I've ever been about a poll. The options just seem so bland. You've got Southside with You, which I'm sure will be fine, but it looks so slight and borderline hokey. I wouldn't be surprised if there was a line in there equivalent to, one day I want to be the next president of the United States, followed by someone saying, that'll never happen. Yuck, yuck, Billy Ray says. And Billy Ray, you're wrong about that. Sully looks like flight minus Zemeckis' understanding of how to tell real human stories. Snowden appears to be another in a long line of missteps from formerly one of the best American directors alive. And The Birth of a Nation will probably be tremendous, but it feels like 12 Years a Slave, the Nat Turner years. I just can't get excited about it, no matter how hard I try. So I voted for Deepwater Horizon, because who the hell knows what Peter Berg is going to come up with. He's made winners, he's made losers, and with a cast including Kurt Russell and John Malkovich, I'm excited to see him try.
Good luck with that, Billy Ray. Aaron from Adelaide, is that Australia?
I believe so.
Okay. Aaron says, I voted for Snowden, although Birth of a Nation Sundance hype has me very curious. But if it was an option, I would have selected other purely because I can't go past Antoine Fuqua and Denzel Washington. Yes, Magnificent Seven is yet another remake, but the pedigree behind it has me truly excited.
Chris in Tennessee says, definitely other Christine. And Josh, Christine is the movie that did get mentioned near the end of our fall movie preview one, I am greatly anticipating Antonio Campos directing Rebecca Hall in the story of Christine Chubbuck, the 70s news anchor who killed herself on air. There's also Kate Plays Christine, as listeners have written into us, Josh, that's coming out. This is the documentary also about Chubbuck.
Here's a note from Isaac Rosso Klakovich in Chapel Hill. The Birth of a Nation was the clear choice for me, as in my mind, Nat Turner's Rebellion is one of the most fascinating events in American history. Even though it was ultimately a logistical failure, it has gone on to be a symbol of hope for African Americans that they can better their situation and don't have to be content with society's unjust laws. If the film can convey the monumental nature of this event and place it in the larger context of American history, it could be one of the best films of the year.
Joel Rackle, I voted for Birth of a Nation, but now wish I hadn't in light of the interview released by Variety today. That's all Joel said, and we want to note that today was August 16th. That was Tuesday. We taped that fall movie preview on Monday, August 15th. And at that point, it came up in the top five during my number one. But at that point, we just heard those initial news stories that were reporting on Nate Parker's past and the rape allegations from his time as a student at Penn State. The follow-up story, the real tragic story that his accuser actually committed suicide a few years ago, that just broke there on the Tuesday after that. So we didn't really get a chance to wrestle with it. And I don't know that we're going to get a chance to wrestle with it here. I know, Josh, that we've talked about this a little bit off air, and we certainly do plan to talk about The Birth of a Nation still on the movie. We understand, without a doubt, the really strong feelings that are out there right now against Nate Parker and some of those conversations that are being had, some of the interviews. I've been following them. I've been reading them. I've been wrestling with them. He had a recent interview in Ebony that I certainly recommend people read. Some of the people who have been very strong against him have acknowledged that article as well and said, okay, we're shifting our thinking, or at least you have our attention a little bit. So there is a dialogue that is ongoing about this that I think is an important one to have, and it's going to continue to happen, obviously, up until this movie's release.
Yeah, it's a very complicated conversation and ongoing dialogue that for us, at least at this point, I feel like we should continue to listen to rather than prematurely weigh in on.
That brings us to our new poll, which looks ahead to this weekend's release of The Light Between Oceans, a movie we did plan to review before we decided to focus on Gene Wilder and Young Frankenstein. We do still hope to catch up with The Light Between Oceans and maybe give it a few minutes on an upcoming show. It's director Derek Cianfrance's adaptation of the 2012 novel. Cianfrance did Blue Valentine and The Place Beyond the Pines. In it, we'll get to see how well a German-Irishman and a Swede do with their Australian accents, hopefully better than we do in Massacre Theater sometimes, Josh. Michael Fassbender, a.k.a. The Fass, a.k.a. Film Spotting Madness Champion.
Trademark.
Michael Fassbender, trademark. In that film, along with Oscar winner Alicia Vikander. Before we dare to compare their accent work in Oceans, we are going to ask you to compare their work as robots. Why not?
Robot deathmatch.
You could argue that certainly his role as the android David in 2012's Prometheus, and Vikander, despite her Oscar win just a little bit earlier this year for The Danish Girl, is probably most associated, at least in film spotting circles, with her role as Ava in last year's Ex Machina. So it's a machine versus machine deathmatch here. Who played the robot better, Josh? Michael Fassbender in Prometheus or Alicia Vikander in Ex Machina?
Was Fassbender the best thing about Prometheus or the only good thing about Prometheus?
How
that's where we start.
Dare you, sir.
So he should get a lot of consideration, but really, I mean, Ex Machina itself was the best film of 2015. Vikander was a big reason for that, so that's where I got to go.
Okay, well, can I say this on air? I voted against Film Spotting Madness champion Michael Fassbender.
Not only can you not say that, you have just breached your contract, sir.
Though I jumped very early on appreciating Alicia Vikander, as you recall.
You did.
For her work in that Joe Wright film.
Anna Karenina. I'm glad it's stuck in your memory so much.
I didn't love it.
She was, interestingly, only good thing about Anna Karenina.
Okay, so. Well, they have that in common besides the fact that they're also a couple in real life. We considered maybe that angle, other real life couples who play couples on screen. But we like the robot question, even though it's not proven to be much of a death match. One of these two robot performers is running away with this one handily. We still encourage you to vote and to leave a comment. You can do that at filmspotting.net. If you leave a comment, and we hope you do, please let us know where you're listening from. We did want to share some notes about upcoming programming here on the show. We usually just kind of look one show ahead because that's almost all we usually have mapped out. And who knows, some of this could change. But right now, it's pretty set. On September 16th, the new Blair Witch movie opens. Josh, this made your top five fall movie preview in terms of one of the questions you had. At this point, it's looking like we might not get to a full review, certainly one we both want to see. We are giving away free passes to see Blair Witch here in Chicago before the movie comes out on September 14th in Chicago. We're also giving away passes for a September 15th screening to the J.T. Leroy story, which sounds really interesting. You can enter to win passes to both of those movies at filmspotting.net.
Both very exciting. We love to give away passes, but this I'm really excited about.
Yeah.
We have confirmed that Matt Zillerseitz, the great TV and film critic and also the author of the upcoming Oliver Stone Experience, I think that's coming out on September 13th. He's going to be on the show.
He is.
He's calling in, and we're going to do A Sacred Cow of Born on the 4th of July, a film I have not seen since its initial release. And Matt is also going to share his top five Oliver Stone scenes. I understand there might be another surprise that we're working on as well.
That's right, but we're certainly not going to let that out before it's confirmed. And we may get to some Snowden talk as well. It really depends on the screening availability and whether or not we get to it. It does open that weekend, the 16th, the same day that the show would air. So we would love to share a few thoughts on it and get Matt's thoughts as well. That just might happen. But we know there are lots of people out there listening to Film Spotting who are fans of Matt Zillerseitz's work when it comes to both film and TV. So exciting for us to finally get him on the show. We're also excited about our next marathon. As we are on this show, wrapping up, or at least discussing the last movie in our Nordic cinema marathon, we are going to get to a Luis Buñuel marathon.
Rolling right into another one. How about that? Usually there's a big gap between these. We're getting serious, and this should be a great one.
It should. It is slated to start on September 30th. The Luis Buñuel marathon is presented by MUBI. Much more info to come, but here's our tentative lineup. We're going to start with a double feature of Un Chien Andalou and L'Âge d'Or.
Both shorts, essentially.
Both, yeah, pretty short movies, so you can fit them in. Robinson Crusoe, followed by Death in the Garden. Now, those films are both, fair to say, lesser-known films from Buñuel, but pretty highly regarded, and they are both available via MUBI. They're available via DVD as well, but for our listeners who love to stream movies and stream them to certain devices, you can watch both of these films via MUBI.
We also plan to get to Diary of a Chambermaid, That Obscure Object of Desire, and then are we going to finish up with Tristana? I know we were talking about Los Olvidados, but that's available, is it?
I think we'll actually end with That Obscure Object of Desire because it's his last film, so
we'll get to bookend
this with his first and his last, but I think that fifth or sixth movie will be Tristana, only because we both really want to see it. But yeah, The Young and the Damned, we can't seem to find it anywhere. It's just not widely available. And that's that disclaimer that usually applies. I want to be sure to apply it here. If you're out there listening to this list and you're saying, where's Belle de Jour? Where's The Exterminating Angel? Where are lots of other great Buñuel films? The factors here in putting together this lineup include what we've seen already and what is available. We want to encourage participation. So not only do we not want to have to run to the library, let's say, as our only option for all of these movies, we want to make sure that our listeners don't have to all seek out their local public library and hope that that's the only place they can get them. We want to give you lots of options. And if you feel passionately that we're making a mistake or you just have words of encouragement for this marathon, email us. We are all ears, and certainly we may change the lineup based on your remarks if it does make sense, if it does fit in with what we're trying to accomplish here. You can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. If you do want to participate, you can check your options for seeing these movies at our marathons page on our website. Just click on marathons, click on the Buñuel link, and we will give you that lineup, and we'll also tell you the different ways you can see these movies. They are all, from what I can tell, Josh, pretty widely available. Un Chien Andalou is the lone exception.
And I do know that is available through the library, so you can go that route. We should also mention maybe the most glaring title that's missing is one we've both seen, The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie.
Right.
So
was one of our big blind spots, and much to the chagrin of the listener, Christopher Reese, who demanded we talk about it, we didn't give it a full 20 to 30 minute discussion. We gave it 5 to 10 minutes on another episode. I think our top five films of 1972 maybe.
That sounds
we
right.
We fit it in. That one, a good film. And yes, since we did just see it and did just talk about it, doesn't make the cut here. As we said, this marathon is being presented by our great partner over at Mubi. And as always, they've got some great selections available right now to stream.
Some really nice timing here. They're resuming their Herzog retrospective called Ecstatic Fictions. This, of course, is just in time for the release of Herzog's latest documentary, Lo and Behold. Currently showing at Mubi is Nosferatu, Herzog's unique and elemental take on Dracula. And they also have Wojciech, which is shot fast on the heels of Nosferatu. It uses the same crew, same star, same location. So there are two essential ones there, and there's more Herzog to come.
Kinski, of course, that star. Klaus Kinski, Isabella Ajani, one of the stars of Nosferatu. Nosferatu made our Werner Herzog, Klaus Kinski marathon back in the early days of film spotting. Highly recommend that film, despite the fact that I'm often terrified by vampires. Josh, they also have, playing now, a Radley Metzger double bill, The Licorice Quartet and Camille 2000. And this is what I love about Mubi, is not only are they bringing up titles here that I'm not familiar with at all, I'd never heard of this filmmaker, and they say it's their most risque double bill. The death of censorship left a brief hope that erotic films could be legit cinema, and Metzger was a celebrated scandalous practitioner. So that film and Herzog's movies playing now over at Mubi. Josh, when are we going to get to our marathon of erotic cinema? I think the listeners
are on the list.
They're crying for it.
I'm sure they are.
Every day, Mubi's curators introduce a new title, and you have 30 days to watch it. That means there's always 30 wonderful films to enjoy, all for only $4.99 a month. Plus, when you use their mobile app, you can download films to watch offline. Our listeners can try Mubi free for a month. Just go to Mubi.com/filmspotting, MUBI.com/filmspotting.
Michelle.
Thought it wasn't a date?
It isn't.
Going to an awful lot of trouble for just another smooth-talking brother.
He's the summer associate I told y'all about, the one from Harvard Law. He invited me to a community event.
So what's this boy's name?
Barack Obama.
Barack Obama.
A clip there from Southside With You, the new movie that takes us back to a summer afternoon in 1989 when the future president of the United States courted his future first lady. It, of course, took place on Chicago's South Side. And this is a movie I really wanted to talk about here on the show. Josh, you didn't get a chance to catch up with this movie over the weekend, so we thought we would phone a friend. We're bringing in Odie Henderson, the critic for RogerEbert.com and Movie Mezzanine. Odie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So I do have to share this with you real quick. After deciding that we were going to have you call in and we're going to have another guest call in here in a minute, we thought maybe we need to turn this into kind of a segment. Like maybe we brand it, we give it a name. And I threw it out there to Josh and Sam and said, what do we call a segment where we ask critics to get on the line and tell us why they love a movie? And our wonderful producer, Sam, showed his brilliance and said, the love line. So you're on the love line. How do you feel about that?
A little bit of regret, maybe, Odie?
I have plenty of questions about my love life, so if you don't mind.
That might take us down a different path than we're willing to
go. Movie reviews and relationship counseling. Why not?
Yeah. I think this would work. You could really make some money out of this.
Maybe so. Or we have the more generic critics on call. So maybe we'll go with that. Whatever we call it.
That makes you sound like a hooker.
Oh, there you go. You're right.
See, now we're all thinking.
Failure.
Now we're all thinking that way.
Okay. Let's get us back on track here. Whatever we decide to call it, it's going to be fun to talk with you here because you really did write a very glowing review of this film, written and directed by Richard Tanna. It stars Parker Sawyers as President Obama, the future President Obama, and Tika Sumpter as Michelle Robinson, of course, at the time. In your review, Odie, you make the comparison to Before Sunrise. Two characters, lots of walking and talking. The location is crucial. But you also note that unlike that film, we already know the ending before the lights go down in the theater. So writer-director Richard Tanna replaces the suspenseful pull of will they or won't they with an equally compelling and understated character study that humanizes his larger-than-life public figures. Tanna reminds us that, before ascending to the most powerful office in the world, Barack and Michelle were just two regular people who started out somewhere much smaller. My question is, do you think Tanna makes these two regular people interesting enough to warrant a movie being made about them, or are they only really interesting because we know who they become, or does that just not matter at all?
I don't think it really matters at all for one reason, because you don't have, I mean, if you, they could have changed the names of these two characters in the movie and done everything exactly the same, and the movie would still have been compelling. There's a chemistry between the two of them. And the fact that as they're walking and talking, and you get this whole feel of the South Side and of the different places they go that have a cultural significance from a black perspective. They do the Gwendolyn Brooks poem. They have the gentleman who painted the pictures for Good Times. It's just a matter of you're dealing with these two people who are slowly falling in love and also kind of putting out some of their anxieties. She's anxious about the way it's going to look if they start dating, and he has these issues with his father that she kind of just teases up to the surface in one of the conversations that they have. So the fact that it's Barack and Michelle, I think, is secondary. What's most interesting about the fact that it is Barack and Michelle is that I tried to do some research to find out if there had been another movie where they took a president and depicted their lives just before they were in politics. And I can only find one, and that was Young Mr. Lincoln, mm-hmm. the
John Ford.
Henry Fonda movie John Ford made. And so I thought it was interesting that this is kind of without much precedent. But I don't think it just because about Barack and Michelle that it would be interesting. Mm-hmm. I think it's just these characters. They make it work. Because I think she's more convincing as Michelle than he is as Barack. So if it was just a matter of caricature or just mimicry, it wouldn't work at all.
Yeah, that brings up a question that I'm curious about having not seen it. So how much do they help you? I find in performances like, say, Will Smith as Muhammad Ali, I'd rather that I forget the actor is trying to be someone. I think Smith did a good job with that here. How do these performances compare in that scenario? Are they trying to provide an impersonation while also inhabiting real life characters? Or do they kind of set the impersonation aspect aside and just go with these two as characters first?
I think they don't impersonate the characters physically. I think they impersonate aspects of the character. So for example, Barack is all swagger, and you can see this isn't the swagger that you see on the president. You can see this is in process. Hmm. It's not perfect. This is kind of like, if it's 10 now, let's say this is 4. and you can see in her that she's no nonsense. And you can see, and sometimes you see pictures of Michelle like looking at Obama like, oh, no, you didn't.
Sure.
And giving him that side eye, and she has that down pat. And so you see that he's trying to impress her with his swagger, and she just is not having it. And I think they kind of embody those elements of personality more than physical.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not really mimicry. She doesn't sound like Michelle Obama, and he doesn't sound like Barack Obama. So, you know, it's not just physical at all. I think it's more of an embodiment of their characteristics, like what you think about when you see them personality-wise.
Yeah, I agree with you completely on that point. I really love Sumter's performance. I love her precision. I agree. It's not so much about trying to channel Michelle Obama, but she just comes off as someone who feels like, and this is true to the character we meet in this film, someone who feels like she has to be precise in everything she does, the way she looks, the way she speaks. She's just determined to be heard and to be understood. And maybe as a man, that's less of a burden for the Barack character here. He doesn't feel the need the way she does, but it really comes through in the performance. And I think, as I said, it's a good one. I'm with you too on this film. I really swooned for this movie. Actually, overall, I agree that I think the details are what matter. This movie gets so many of the details right. And there is just a certain electricity to watching passionate people on screen, regardless of who they might become. There's a little bit of added electricity when they're as smart and attentive to each other and as curious as these two people are. I think that's what really held me through this film. And one of the first responses I had walking out of it actually was I really wanted to immediately go home and grab my two oldest kids and take them to the movie. Holden is 14, Sophie's 12. And I just felt like this is a PG-13 film. Otherwise, there's nothing about it that makes it a film a kid shouldn't see. But just trying to expose kind of young teens like that to an adult romance and show them what it's like when you feel that first spark, when you make a connection with someone, even if it's not an immediate spark, and then expose them to these characters having a real sense of purpose, just being engaged in the world. I don't think that us knowing that they become the president and first lady affects how inspiring this movie ultimately really is, because it's really about the journey anyway. It's just about these characters taking those first steps. So I'm recommending it to lots of people, including some mothers and fathers out there.
Yeah, I think it works really well just as romance. A lot of times, and I've mentioned this before in my reviews, romantic comedy is always the hardest genre to pull off, and it shouldn't be. It should be easy. You got two people you want to fall in love, you put them together, and then basically that's it. And a lot of times it's so overcomplicated, they add these extra characters, they do stupid things, and you lose the sense of wonder or the discovery. The best part of this movie is watching these two characters discover each other. Mm-hmm. And also, I kind of like the fact that Barack smokes like a chimney.
I know.
You know, there are things. You know he's sneaking cigarettes in the White House and yeah. telling the Secret Service, don't you dare tell Michelle I had this Newport.
100%. Yeah.
And that's why it's PG-13. The MPAA, I'm surprised they didn't slap an R on it because, I mean, he goes through about three packs of cigarettes.
He does. He does.
In 82 minutes.
But that's about all it has in that regard. Anything else, Odie, you want to mention about the film or anything you want to plug?
Oh, I mean, I just think people should go see it. It's not – I think people have the wrong impression that it's going as some endorsement of the Obamas, which they don't need an endorsement. They're done. They're not running for office anymore. So if this had come out 8 years ago, I could see some of the arguments that I've gotten in some of the mail that I've received about this review, that they really don't have – there's no political agenda at all. So it's just a love story, and I think people should go see it based on that. It doesn't make a difference who you are, what your affiliation is, what color you are. It's just a nice love story, and it's nice to see two adults on the screen talking.
I agree. And to that point, it did actually occur to me, and I wonder if people would disagree with me here, but to people out there, let's say, who are Trump supporters, right, and they would never get near this multiplex to see this movie, I feel like if they didn't know it was about Barack Obama and Michelle Obama, it was just these two people who had different names, and they went and watched this movie, I dare say they would actually be inspired by these people and they would be caught up in their romance and they would be rooting for them and they would be genuinely moved by it the same way we are, whether we are, you know, sympathetic to the Obamas or not. Unfortunately, we don't live in the world where people can turn off those blinders.
Right. I mean, if this were made about Trump and Melania and it was like this, I would say, well, you know, it's
got to rethink it.
They made his
Big Apple with you.
Big Apple with you. Yes, absolutely. The print. You're fired. The movie.
Yeah.
It's just a nice little sweet romance. And I think if you're in the mood for that, you should go. And it's funny. People don't realize it's a comedy. It's pretty damn funny.
Yep. Yeah. There's some great lines and some great moments for sure. Odie, it was a real treat to have you on the show. Where can listeners follow you online?
I am at Twitter at Odinator, and I am at RogerEbert.com as usual during my reviews. I also do recaps at Vulture.com on occasion, but that's TV. And that's a different medium. But yeah, so that's the easiest way to get a hold of me.
Great. This was fun. Let's do it again sometime.
Thanks, Odie. Absolutely. Take care.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Stay right there. Don't you move. Yeah, that's right. I know what's in there, and I ain't leaving without it. You got me? Now you do as I say, all right? Well, do you hear me or what? I said stop.
Right.
Don't you move!
A clip there from the little horror thriller Don't Breathe, which has been well received not only by critics, but by audiences as well. And a little strange that you got to this before me, Adam.
Yeah.
Horror, I'm a little more open to than you in general.
Right.
And also, the director here, Fed Alvarez, made 2013's Evil Dead remake, which I, and you'll never let me forget this, claimed was better than the original Evil Dead.
Of course you did.
And I stand by that.
I'm sure
his remake, you know, the way the story elements that he brought to that, and not to say it isn't gory like the original, but the way he used gore to specific purpose really impressed me. So Don't Breathe is certainly one that I need to see. You beat me to it. What'd you think?
You do need to see it. It's about a group of three friends who break into houses. They are not too ambitious about it. They set their sights low. They know just what to get away with on these heists to not get in too much trouble if they ever get caught. And they do make the mistake of trying to bite off more than they can chew. This movie is much more of a thriller than it is a horror movie. It's being marketed as a horror movie. I get that from a marketing standpoint. And there are certainly a few jump scares in the movie, and there are some disturbing situations, and there is a little bit of gore. But this really fundamentally, Josh, is a heist gone horribly wrong movie. I would not call it a horror film, despite the title and the poster.
Yeah.
And again, the marketing campaign that really makes it
seem
like
that. Well, and Alvarez being involved, too.
Right. That would be totally fair. And I don't know what your specific praise was for The Evil Dead, but I'm guessing his use of the space had to be among the things you enjoyed about it, based on what I saw in Don't Breathe anyway, The Evil Dead, a movie mostly confined to a single location, as this movie is as well. And the way the camera here maneuvers through the space of this house and the way Alvarez lays out the floor plan really does raise the tension, because it puts us there. We know every single corner and every single creaky floor in this place, and it does put us right in the middle of the action. But you mentioned storytelling, and that was actually what impressed me most about this movie, the way Alvarez sets up the stakes really concisely and really neatly, but not in an overly clever way or not in too much of a heavy-handed way either. Are they going to get away with it is only so compelling in any heist movie. What's really compelling is when we really understand and are invested in the reasons why they're trying to get away with it, and why, if you can do this as well, the reasons why their target is trying to stop them from getting away with it. Some details are slowly revealed, but all we need to understand about each character, each of the three, and why they're in the situation is established within the first 10 minutes of this film. It's focused mainly on a character named Rocky, played by Jane Levy. She's very good in the film. And there's nothing subtle about what she's trying to escape from when we see those scenes of domestic bliss. But Alvarez shows us what the other two members of their crew are after as well. He gives us just enough insight into who they are to understand what's motivating them and to set up their actions later in the movie. I do think that by the end, it chases its tail a little bit, and it's curious that Stephen Lang, the great actor and a great physical presence who plays the blind man whose house they're trying to rob, there are times, Josh, where he has a daredevil-like sense of smell and hearing when the plot needs him to, and then there are 17 other instances where he's completely oblivious, but those are nitpicks. It really is a movie I recommend you see.
Jane Levy also in Evil Dead, where she plays a drug addict, and that lends this allegorical layer to what's going on there. So, yeah, I'll check this out soon. Don't Breathe is in wide release and performing well. If you've seen it before me, let us know what you think. Feedback at filmspotting.net.
That little harpy, she's a nerd, but I got a thing for redheads, don't you?
I don't know.
I'll take it. Tyson's such a douchebag.
Well, not in the end, he's not. I just finished the Blood of Olympus.
I got the game. Want to play?
Now?
Yeah.
I'd like to, but I can't. It's my grandfather's funeral.
Yeah, I know. Never enough to say in these situations.
I think you're supposed to say, I'm sorry for your loss.
That's it.
Here, could you carry this?
Oh, yeah, sure.
One more film to talk about and one more guest critic to help us out. That was a scene from Little Men, out in limited release now. It opens here in Chicago this weekend. We have with us on the line a first-time guest on the show, Alan Schurstel, the film editor for The Village Voice. Alan, thanks for doing this.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's good to be on a show that one listens to.
That always helps. Yeah, we're really happy to have you on. I want to say thanks, Alan. A few years ago, you invited us to be part of the year-end Village Voice Film Critics Poll, and that was a big deal to be included, so we really appreciate that.
Oh, well, thank you guys for contributing. And I'm going to do that. You know, the thing I love most when somebody says, like, oh, it's great to be on the show, very often they'll say, like, a couple minutes later, wait, can I swear on this show? Like, they've never actually heard it.
Right.
I promise not to do that.
Sounds good.
Well, we can bleep you for radio anyway if you really feel good. Compelled. I don't think Little Men will probably bring that out of you, though. This is the latest film from Ira Sachs. He's made, by my count, 6 previous features. I'm only familiar with the last two before Little Men, Keep the Lights On from 2010 and Love is Strange, which was one of my top 10 films of 2014. I mentioned a few weeks ago on the show that I thought, just based on the plot description for Little Men, that it would be a bit of a departure for Sachs, namely that both of those other two movies are about gay couples. One set is in their 20s, the other in their twilight years, and Little Men is about a couple of 13-year-old boys, Jake and Tony, who meet and they bond and they rebel against their parents when the adults get into a property dispute. But as you discussed in your review, Alan, this is very much in line with those previous two movies and actually kind of culminates a trilogy that was all written by Sachs along with Mauricio Zacharias.
Yes, I believe it does. And Sachs himself has spoken about that. I saw him, you know, I saw him speak after a screening of the film, and our Bilge Abiri interviewed him, and he talked about that as well there. You know, the fact that these are – all three of these films are about love, and they're often about real estate and the way that real estate can impinge upon love, and particularly New York real estate, which, you know, if you've seen Love is Strange, the great film with John Lithgow and
– Alfred Molina.
Alfred Molina.
Little Men, yeah.
Yes, just very briefly. You know, I mean, this is a longtime couple who has been – they lose their apartment. New York is too expensive for them, and they kind of have to go their own separate ways because they can't find any place that will accommodate both of them, you know, while they try to get their financial and real estate life together. And here we have the same – you know, kind of a similar situation, except that the two men – young men at the center of the film this time are not – really in love. They're not really a couple. We don't know whether or not either is gay actually throughout the course of the film, and it really doesn't matter. And I find it fascinating that you know, Sachs is, you know, here we have a classic auteur. We have a director whose interests are first and foremost in every frame of every film, a great humanist, one of the great filmmakers of our time. And in this trilogy he's done, it's the two films where there's really no sex, no chance of having to see men hook up. It's those two films that are catching on, and that kind of annoys me a little bit. And I'm hoping that people will go back and see the earlier one as well.
Well, you obviously mentioned this, the fact that there is some ambiguity with relation to this couple, if you will, Jake, who's played by Theo Taplitz, and Tony, played by Michael Barbieri. I think I've seen at least one or two people comment online that ambiguity was actually a source of frustration for them, that the movie seemed like maybe it was pulling its punches a little bit, or Sachs was being kind of willfully obtuse, I guess. But that obviously wasn't a problem for you.
Oh, by no means. And in fact, when I heard Sachs speak about this film, he talked about how, you know, he had a pretty specific ideas, you know, in the writing about who these characters are going to be and whether they were gay. But that, you know, once it's cast and once these actors are doing the scenes, it kind of has to go with their energy. And, you know, these two young men are figuring out who they are over the course of this film. And, you know, they start to feel, you know, the characters start to feel as the movie goes on that the world is looking at them and the world is wondering about this relationship and its peculiar intensity. And, you know, it might just be the heightened friendship of young men who don't have anybody else really to turn to in their lives, or it might be the beginnings of something more romantic. But that's really not clear to them. And I actually found it really refreshingly honest that Sachs just lets them kind of groove in the moment together, demonstrates like the hole they fill in each other's lives for each other, but is not, you know, necessarily after a tragic love story or anything like that. And by not doggedly pursuing that and giving us those very familiar scenes of characters who feel things and yearn for each other but can't actually be together, by instead just treating it in this much more kind of low-key, humane way, I found the movie, you know, at its conclusion, which I don't want to spoil by any means, just tremendously moving, so much more so than in films that hit those emotional beats harder.
Yeah, it sounds like if the characters themselves don't know those answers yet, it would be unfair or unwise to craft a story that's trying to give them. So maybe, I'm not sure if it works that way, but...
And I'm just not sure about the usefulness of critics looking at this work of art about, you know, this work of narrative art about two young men and focusing all their energies on whether or not these characters are gay. I've seen several reviews do that. And, you know, I really hope you don't do that with like the young men who have friendships that you know in your own life.
Right.
Let them be. Sure. Let them figure it out for themselves.
Yeah. The big connection for me with those other two films is kind of, here I'm going to restate what you already said in talking about real estate, but this is another movie about people who are decent. They're fundamentally pretty good people. They're not perfect, certainly, but they find it harder and harder to be decent because of a situation that they just can't control or they can't reconcile. And Scott Tobias put it perfectly in his review. He said, it's a clash of unfortunate circumstances and contrary motives. And that's what Ira Sachs seems to make movies about. But he's really wise about the world, I think, and wise about people, in that he recognizes that there usually isn't the type of reconciliation we want to see or the type of reconciliation we hope to achieve in our own lives. That's just not realistic. And he's not cynical by any stretch either, I don't think. But there's no winners in his movies. There are no real losers either, just people going about their lives.
Do you ever think about anybody other than yourselves? Huh? Say something, Jake. Say something! One of the hardest things to realize when you're a child is that your parents are people too. You understand that? They care about things. They make mistakes. That they try to do what they think is the right thing to do. Does any of what I'm saying make any sense to you?
You know, you have Greg Kinnear in this movie as the father of the young boy, Jake. And he has a financial relationship with the other boy's guardian. Is it his mother, his guardian?
Yeah, his mother.
It's been a couple of weeks since I saw it. And the role kind of demands that the Greg Kinnear character has to be the bad landlord, the one who says, look, I'm sorry, the rents, the price of the neighborhood, everything, we cannot continue to allow you to run your small shop out of this building that we own when we could get three or four times the rent. It's financially irresponsible of us to do that. And the heartbreak you see in Greg Kinnear's eyes and his face and his every moment as he has to do this is just as moving for me as much of what the young boys are feeling. And, you know, you've never – when do you see that in the movie? You never actually see in the beach comedy, you know, why the guy has to tear down the surf shop. You never right. get that.
No.
And here it's just here is another good person who is in circumstances that are beyond him and that he can't quite control, and he has to do what he has to do. But he does not have the luxury that the young men have. The young men in the movie have the luxury of still being idealistic.
Yeah, that's for sure. And I think on the flip side of that, that mother character, Talia Balsam, is the actress. She, in many scenes, has to be pretty mean directly to Greg Kinnear's character. I mean, she is saying very hurtful things, but it doesn't come from a place, I think, it doesn't come from a place of her just trying to insult him or to try to manipulate the situation to get what she wants. There's real pain there too, not just in what's being potentially taken away from her, but because of the relationship she had with his father, which is another storyline there. So you understand the motivations for both characters here. You understand the pain that underlines what both characters are going through. And I think that's what makes Iris Sachs's movies so rich overall. And I wanted to ask you one other question about your review, where you mention a scene that features the character Tony. He is in an acting class, and he's the one who says he wants to be an actor. And he gets into this big improvisational exercise with his instructor. And you said in your review that Barbieri's freestyle expectorations dazzle so much that I applauded at my screening. So I take you literally at your word there that you did applaud. I just love it when movies actually provoke those types of outward reactions in us.
Well, fortunately, I was not seeing this at a regular critic screening, you know, where you slump into chairs with 12 other people who are kind of in this competition to see who could look the most miserable and unimpressed. And instead,
that's it.
That is so accurate.
I saw this with an actual audience. And actually, I saw Sachs watching the audience watch the movie. So it was a pretty complicated situation for me right there. And I think he looked surprised at how much the audience responded to that moment. I mean, this is an extended scene of just, you know, Michael Barbieri, a young man who's got this bristling young Pacino aspect to him, but totally innocent. You know how critics like to say of an actor, oh, he's a natural, you know, which I always find kind of like accidentally backhandedly insulting because, you know, the natural actor works really, really hard to achieve those effects that move you. Well, here we have a kid so young that, you know, he probably is kind of a natural, and we actually watch him in an acting class rehearsal, and it goes on and on, him shouting back and forth with his acting coach, and it's just this beautiful, blistering, building moment that mounts and mounts, and it's hilarious. It's weirdly moving. And it's almost like this kid's audition tape is spliced into the movie. And it's no surprise to me that the kid was immediately snapped up by Marvel to play the best friend of Spider-Man in the next Spider-Man.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And it was news that Iris Sachs mentioned at the screening that the kid was cast as Spider-Man's best friend. The internet only knew he was cast in Spider-Man.
Oh.
So that was got a scoop there.
Yeah. Breaking news. Absolutely. Well, we felt like we needed to have a New Yorker on to talk about a New York film. So thank you for doing this, Alan.
That's sweet. I'm a kid from Kansas who somehow got into this.
All right. Midwestern pride. That's that works for us.
Even
Alan,
better.
Let's have you on again sometime. It was a lot of fun.
Hey, thanks. Been fun, guys. Have a good night.
Thanks, Alan.
How long have you been doing this exercise?
How long you've been doing this exercise?
How long have you been doing this exercise?
How long have you been doing this exercise?
I'm not playing with you.
I'm not playing with you.
You know, you make me make mistakes in my own exercise.
You know, you make me make mistakes in my own exercise.
You make me make mistakes in my own exercise.
You make me make mistakes in my own exercise.
I make you make mistakes in your own exercise.
I make you make mistakes in your own exercise.
I make you make mistakes in your own exercise.
I make you make mistakes in your own exercise.
I make this exercise the way I like it.
I make the exercise the way I like it.
Little Men, again, out now in limited release and obviously highly recommended by Alan and me.
Well, that's a show right there, but we're not done yet. Our Nordic Cinema Marathon continues when we come back with Rams, an Icelandic film that just had a limited release in the U.S. earlier this year. Stay with us.
Kristinn Böðvarsson með rútingsbrota.
Some of the trailer for the 2015 film Rams, a prize winner at last year's Cannes Film Festival. Usually, Adam, the studio feels like a bar, minus the beers, unfortunately, where we're hanging out together, having fun, talking movies. But sometimes, on rare occasions, Wolf of Wall Street, maybe Morris from America, it can feel like the setting for Rams, the Icelandic entry in our contemporary Nordic cinema marathon, in which a pair of brothers who operate neighboring sheep farms are buried so deep in a family feud that they haven't spoken to each other in 40 years. I loved Rams from its gorgeous landscape photography to its nearly mute but mesmerizing performances. But how about you? Things about to get frigid, or will this be a cozy conversation?
Well, I'm just really disappointed that at no point in that intro did I hear you attempt to pronounce the names of the actors who portray those two brothers.
Oh, I've got them here. The director, too. I'm ready for you.
Lay it on me.
What do you need?
Set us up.
Do you want to know about Grímur Hakonarson or Sigurður Jónsson or Theodor Júlíusson?
What? That doesn't look like how it's spelled at all.
That Gumi would have been Gumi? The brother we mostly spend time with. Uh-huh. The younger one. I think he's younger.
He is
and
younger.
And then Kitty is the older brother. Now, those two names, I'm not sure I have right.
Kitty
actually, I probably
don't
have any of that right, but I tried.
No, it sounded really good.
Okay.
It sounded really good, and we're going to go with it. But I really like this movie, too, Josh. So, no, it won't be a frigid scenario.
Nice.
And I was thinking back to our discussion a few weeks ago of 1001 Grams, and we both lamented how that film, the Norwegian movie, really just overused its metaphor, its central metaphor. And this film provides a nice counter, I think, to 1,000 Grams in terms of how to properly use a metaphor, because it doesn't take much to look at these two brothers and recognize that they are the rams of the title, or could be those rams. They are like their rams and sheep in demeanor and in disposition. They've got the scraggly white hair. They talk and emote about as much as the rams do. But more significantly, they are the last of their breed. There's no wives. There's no kids. When they go, their breed goes, just like the sheep that they are ordered to slaughter. That breed is gone forever. So there is a lot at stake here in not only this sibling rivalry, but in terms of what they are being asked to do and how it relates to them, not to mention the obvious fact that this is not only their way of life, but they feel a bond with these sheep. And the director not only doesn't overdo the metaphor, he really doesn't overdo anything here. I think any viewer is going to have a certain expectation of where this movie is going to go, estranged brothers forced together by some kind of tragic event. And there's enough whimsy to it, mm-hmm. and enough deadpan whimsy that we would expect from this marathon, that it would make sense if it did culminate in some sort of satisfying, lighthearted way. I will say that it culminates in a satisfying way, not necessarily a lighthearted one. I do think we get the emotional closure we crave, but without the cloyingness of, let's say, a Hollywood movie.
Well, there's a lot of ambiguity there, too.
There's a lot of ambiguity, and it just doesn't manipulate us.
You know why that metaphor is so great? It didn't occur to me until you just started describing
it. I'm glad to be of service.
It's obviously there now that you're pointing that out. I feel a little stupid, but maybe I was distracted by this photography that I mentioned, this valley that they live in, and the way that Hecko Norsen captures that as, yes, echoing their personalities too, the way they both want to be apart. Even if they were on good terms, you have a sense that they might speak to each other a little bit more, but not a lot. And this long plain of the valley with these craggy hills or mountains on either side works well for that. And I also like how Hecko Norsen slowly moves the camera in. He has some really elegant framing here, but what's interesting about the move that a lot of filmmakers make when their camera will close in almost imperceptibly is usually where we end up is not as interesting to look at as where we left, just because there's less space to work with. But frequently here, the camera rests on a very planned out close-up of some sort that's just as compelling visually. Mm-hmm. So that was fun to follow throughout the film. And I have to say also, in terms of performances, some of these, this deadpan acting style that we've encountered a lot in this marathon, it can be, for me, can be difficult to judge what's a good performance, right? Because they're so emotively removed, even when they're not trying to be funny. But keeping those emotions down.
Removed is a good word.
Yeah.
You feel distance from them.
How do I, acting is one of those really difficult things for me because I have no experience with it. How do I assess whether this is quote unquote good, right? Whether the actors are performing the role in a way that's above and beyond what someone else might do. Now, Sigurjonsson, who plays Gummy, this is the brother we're mostly with, he does get one very emotional scene. So that's clear to see what's going on there. I think he pulls it off.
He does.
Wonderfully. But what I really appreciate about his performance are the way he establishes character through action so much. And of course, that's going to have to happen in a movie with so little dialogue. But you mentioned one thing about how they relate to the sheep. And his instinct is always to caress them unless he has to get rough, when, you know, if the rams are not moving where he needs them to be. But I like how we see that instinct to be soft with them. And how about the moment where Kitty shoots out his window? And how does he react to that the next morning? He's just replacing the glass pane.
And then sending him the invoice.
And sending him the invoice through the dog, a touch that I love. And then one of my favorite scenes in the movie is when Gummy is having his Christmas dinner alone. And he gets dressed up. He lights candles. There's music playing and he's making a roast. And he starts singing along.
It's a side of him we haven't seen.
We haven't seen. And you almost wonder if he saves his voice even for himself for that one day a year.
Yeah, it's a special treat.
Yeah, it's just a really beautiful, I guess it's not dialogue-free, but a lovely character moment built on action.
Yeah, and there are so many wonderful character moments like that in this film. I'm really glad you brought up that Christmas dinner in particular because it does stand out where we get to see Gummy as a human being in that scene. And again, there are other scenes like it, but he's not just a quirky character. He's not just a deadpan character. He is a human being who will have a warm moment as he's preparing dinner and he's having a glass of wine or whatever he's doing and he's humming the music. We can all relate to that. And we see a side of him that we otherwise don't see. And I do think that the actor, you should say his name again because you can do it much better than me.
That would be Sigurjonsson.
Mm-hmm. He invites us to study him in a way, and the camera does, but I think the performance does. It invites us in. There's not much there in terms of it being a big performance. It's mostly stoic.
And you got to get through a lot of beard.
You got to get through some beard, but I do think there is something going on in the performance that elevates it above your average deadpan, I don't react to the world. He doesn't react a lot with emotion either, but there are some key moments, and it's enough to show the cracks in that craggy face that just make us really want to look at him closely and study him scene to scene. And I agree that the cinematography is wonderful. There are lots of wide shots. The widescreen is really used effectively here, and not just to emphasize the landscape, but to emphasize the space around these men. Mm-hmm. I was always aware, especially when they're in frames together, how small they are against the scope of this landscape, really against the scope of history. And this whole region seems so rooted in its history. There's an overwhelming sense of their insignificance, but I think that heightens the significance of the survival of their way of life. It's all they have. It's all that matters to them. It may seem small in the grand scheme of the universe, but again, I think that only makes what they're trying to cling on to seem all that much more desperate and meaningful.
Yeah, the sense of time and place that you're talking about, that's one of the things that I did feel was missing from Morris from America. I feel here like I know almost every inch of their farms. Mm-hmm. I know how to get from Gummy's farm to Kitty's farm. I almost feel like I know how to get into town.
Right.
And there's such specificity here. And you're right. The importance of that is because it's not only how it matters for them right now. It's how it mattered for their father before mm-hmm. them and for the generations. I mean, there's so much here that gradually comes to the fore about family covenant, really, and tradition. And this movie becomes much more intense from that whimsical beginning you alluded to, where there's that funny moment they're going to the ram judging contest and they both share a road, their farm share a road with a gate. And Gummy has opened the gate and here comes Kitty blaring by on his all-terrain vehicle, doesn't even nod, you know, or give him any sort of acknowledgement, just takes off right through it. So there are a lot of little funny touches like that. But as this grows more serious, it reminded me of the documentary Brother's Keeper, the one about, I think it's from 92, the hermit siblings in upstate New York, where one of them is accused of murdering another. I mean, things get that intense and that serious between these two, yet it never feels out of tone with the whimsical parts at the beginning. It sort of builds up to that naturally. Mm-hmm.
I saw a comment on Letterboxd from a critic who liked the movie, and he noted in his comments that the origin of their feud is never specified. And I guess it depends on how specific you want to get if you want to say that's true or not, because there is one line that Gummy says in the film that reveals everything we need to know to understand how they could go without speaking to each other for 40 years despite living next door to each other that whole time.
I think it hints
just enough.
Like, yeah, right.
It has the elements of, again, family rooted in history and a decision that one character makes that you can see how, you can understand how in this space, in this time, in this place, it would divide those two men in a way that for one of them is completely unforgivable. I felt like that came through and Haakon Arsen didn't need to dwell on it at all. We should also mention, along with the cinematography, the score. An Icelandic composer, Atli Orvarsson, he uses music here. I love when films, this is just me when it comes to music, but the way Haakon Arsen uses it is it punctuates silence, it punctuates some moments of real grief and despair, and it's used primarily in transitions. It's not there to underline the emotions or be sort of a wall-to-wall soundtrack to try to heighten those emotions. He uses it when he needs to use it, and he allows the sound design to really draw us in. I don't know that I've ever been as aware watching a film as I was watching this one of the sound boots make in snow. You know, all these shots of one brother passed out in the snowdrift and the other brother, that long trudge up to him and then having to carry him back or whatever. You just become really aware of all of the sounds that make up life in this place. Now, as we talk about a few moments of whimsy that actually do occur in this movie, when we eventually get to our awards for this marathon, it's going to be really hard for me to pick a better moment or scene than Gummy picking up his drunk, passed out, near-death brother.
Where you're going.
Laying in the snow with a tractor.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that's called. Whatever the piece of a tractor is, the plow, basically. You use it to dig up dirt, right?
Yes.
He digs up his brother because he can't carry him.
I mean, I thought he was dead at that point.
I know. He's dead.
He's taking him to the hospital.
He can't carry his brother. He doesn't seem to have a vehicle that he could put him in, even if he could pick him up. So he uses the tractor to pick him up. And then we actually get the journey. It's not like the hospital is around the corner.
No.
They're out
they
in the middle of nowhere. They
got
to cross the river.
I know
river
exactly
on the
where
bridge.
They have to go.
they have to get there. And it's this whole journey. And what does he do? Just rolls up to the emergency room entrance and plops his brother down.
And then goes on.
No real remorse or sympathy, but he's at least going to keep his brother alive. That was so funny.
That's a great scene.
So funny.
Give me the name of the composer.
I was going to make you do it. Atli Orvarsson.
Okay, that's just so I don't get all the crap when we've completely butchered these.
Well, are we done butchering Nordic cinema names, at least until those awards?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Okay. We hope you have enjoyed this marathon. We hope you will help us come up with a good name for these awards. We have one. Sam threw out the said tubas, a reference to Roy Anderson, and not Songs from the Second Floor, but You the Living.
It was more You the Living.
Yeah, it was You the Living. We have a couple
really
thoughts.
They really upped the tuba there.
They did. So we may go with that, but if you've been following along, maybe you have a great idea. The deadpans doesn't quite work. We think we can be more clever than that. We'd love to know what you think. Email us feedback@filmspotting.net. And if you see Rams, which you certainly have opportunities to see, it's on Netflix. It's available to rent on most digital platforms. I believe streaming on Netflix as well. So if you do see it and you agree or disagree with us, tell us what you thought. feedback@filmspotting.net.
How about some voicemails too? We had a bunch of good ones for our 600 show celebration. But we can use those for every show. Leave yours at 312-264-0744. You can also find that number under the About Us tab at filmspotting.net. We're also on Facebook and on Twitter. Adam's at Filmspotting. I'm at Larson on Film.
And as we are closing out that Nordic Cinema Marathon, wanted to remind you that our next marathon will be devoted to the work of Spanish filmmaker Luis Buñuel. The lineup for that, along with a complete list of previous marathons, is available at filmspotting.net. Just click on the marathons link at the top of the page.
Also at filmspotting.net, you can find 11 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives. Those are all in the show archives. While you're there, go ahead and vote in the current Film Spotting poll. Who played the robot better, Michael Fassbender or Alicia Vikander?
There's no point, though. This one's over.
It is.
I'm calling it.
Check it out and see if you want to try to do what you can to change that. And if you haven't already, we ask that you do check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts. We've got The Next Picture Show and Film Spotting SVU. You can find both in iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
Out in limited release, The Hollers. A man returns to his small hometown after learning that his mother has fallen ill and is about to undergo surgery. John Krasinski from The Office is the director. Anna Kendrick co-stars along with Margot Martindale, Richard Jenkins, and Charlton Copley. Little Men, also out. The latest from Ira Sachs, highly recommended by me. And Mia Madre 1, I was hoping to recommend, but didn't have a chance to see Josh. I was watching too many other films, but the latest from Nanni Moretti, great Italian filmmaker, playing at the Music Box this weekend.
Here's one I can suggest that you seek out, Miss Sharon Jones, a documentary. It comes from Barbara Koppel, and Koppel does some interesting things exploring this unsung musical figure and turning it into an exploration of alternative American history. But the real draw is Sharon Jones, someone I was unfamiliar with beforehand. Now I listen to her stuff all the time.
I think we did play a little bit of her music on this show maybe a few years ago. And Barbara Koppel, legendary documentarian, of course, famous for Harlan County, USA, among others. So that is one I really want to see. Out in wide release, Morgan, a movie about a corporate risk management consultant who has to decide whether or not to terminate an artificial being's life that was made in a laboratory environment with Kate Mara.
Not
Don't
Mara.
Call her Mara. Jennifer Jason Lee and Paul Giamatti and The Light Between Oceans, an adaptation of the 2012 novel starring Alicia Vikander and Michael Fassbender. That was the movie we were planning to discuss, but now we're really excited next week on the show to have a Sacred Cow discussion about Young Frankenstein. We're going to pay a little bit of tribute there, of course, to Gene Wilder. We're going to share our top five 21st century comedies as well. So the best purely comedic films, the funniest movies, in our opinion, from 2000 to 2015. The great Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune will be part of this show. He's going to call in from Venice, probably highlight a few of the titles he saw there in Venice, but he's going to share his number one comedy of the 21st century and offer some of his insights on Wilder as well.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. Our music this week came from Iceland's Dreamwife. It's from the new EP, EP01. More information is at dreamwife.bandcamp.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
So for my birthday.
Yes.
Sarah says.
Which was actually
Monday.
Monday.
Like on Friday or Saturday, sort of ominously. Actually, it might have been Sunday. I think it was Sunday night. She said, okay, for your birthday, you need to set aside an hour. You have to be available for an hour in the morning on Tuesday.
This doesn't seem like something that would go over well with you.
And I'm thinking, hey, now's the time for a strippergram. I'm okay with that. If that's where you're going, I mean,
yeah,
it seems a little odd. I had sort of misunderstood.
Totally Sarah's style.
Yeah, and thought that she meant I had to be at home, like something was going to be delivered.
Okay.
That's what I assumed. Well, then she finally tells me Monday night what it is because I have to go somewhere to do this. And it turns out she set me an appointment to get a shave.
What?
You know, like a professional shave at a barber. Like that's all they do. They don't cut your hair or anything. They just give
just
you
the shave.
The shave, like you see in movies before
she needed
some
to give
mob
you, like,
guy gets whacked.
A month warning so you could grow something.
Well, that was. So here's the funny part, actually. I wasn't planning on telling you this part, but you joke, because unlike you, I don't really grow facial hair. And it had only been one day.
Yeah.
You know, I had to shave the previous day.
Shave.
And so then I go and I say that to the guy who wasn't much for conversation. I was hoping for maybe some old school banter or something, but he was just all business.
That's what I would expect.
Straight razor, the whole hot towels,
towel.
All that stuff, right?
Nice.
And at one point I said to him, you know, I wish I could have given you a little bit more to shave, but, you know, this is just one day for me and one day doesn't do a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, that's just one day? Oh, wow. But I don't know what he meant by that, because if one day's the lowest, what
right.
would I have said? Like, yeah, that's 12 hours growth? Or, I mean,
I don't
just,
think he was listening to you.
No, I don't think he was either, but he said, oh, wow, and made
oh, wow.
me feel really immature.
Okay.
So it was an experience. I mean,
is this going to be a habit?
No. A, it's too expensive. And B, it's actually not relaxing at all.
No.
They are up there manipulating your face in ways that my face has never been manipulated. He is just with his fingers digging all over your face and pulling it around. And then they're putting on the creams and the aftershave. And
no. The whole social interaction of haircuts has always
yeah,
given
I'm not,
me the willies.
I would prefer to just sit there and stare straight ahead too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Robots cutting your hair.
You're all for it.
Are we there yet?
I don't know
if
why.
If they're driving our cars, can't they
you
cut
know
our
what,
hair?
You know what it was though, Josh? It was because I was nervous about it, right? Because you're going into something you've never experienced before and you have no idea how it's going to go. So you kind of want someone to put you at ease. And he didn't put me at ease at all, which doesn't mean he did a bad job. He did a great job, but he didn't put me at ease.
There are also no movie scenes of comfortable shaving.
No, I was going to say, again, it's like.
I mean, usually it goes really badly.
I'm thinking of Mississippi Burning, Gene Hackman spinning Brad Dorff around and cutting his neck. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what I'm envisioning when
wasn't
I
it
go
in the
in.
Recent Roy Anderson? Which one of the Roy Andersons is the – that's
oh, yeah.
just a haircut though, right? That he shaves
that
the guy
the
bald.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
But,
so
yeah.
I don't know. It was still an experience. I'm glad I did it. My face certainly has never felt like that before.
It doesn't hurt. It's not like –
oh, no, it hurt.
But afterwards too, is it like
yeah,
sore? Because that's really
I
why I don't
irritation.
Do a full shave
yeah.
often.
Okay.
You know?
Well, that was part of the reason I wanted to go, and that's why my wife bought it for me, is because she knows that I've talked about this, wanting to do it, not just to experience it, but because I literally just figured out how to shave a couple of years ago. And what I mean is I figured out how to shave for my face. Like the right side of my neck never looks the same as my left, and I finally did.
Harry's isn't sponsoring this week, is?
I still use Harry's, and I love their razors, Josh, for
is
the record.
Is this where we're
no,
going
they're
here?
Not. No, no, they're not a sponsor anymore.
Okay.
But what I realized is, and I don't know if I'm unique in this or not, but because I'm right-handed,
mm-hmm.
I think I shave the left side of my face much better than the right side of your face because it's an awkward, it's
makes
not
sense.
A natural position, right?
Mm-hmm.
And no matter what I do on the right side, I tend to get razor burn. And I just finally figured out a couple tricks to avoid that. So I've always been very peculiar about how I shave. And I always thought, well, if a professional would only shave me, like maybe they could show me some tips. Of course, the guy didn't talk to me. And then he proceeded to shave the right side of my neck the way I never in a million years would. And I got some razor burn, but it was still worth it.
It was a very thoughtful gift. Very personal.
It was.
I like those kinds.
That's
I can't get away
exactly
with those
right.
because surprises don't go over well with Debbie. I usually have to work from a list. That's the way to make it a good birthday for her.
Right.
So, which is, you know, I'd rather be a little more creative, but I guess it's her birthday, so yeah. What can you do?
We didn't get a chance because of the 600 show, and we were so stressed out about that, and we were on a deadline. We didn't get to talk about s'mores, but I don't know if there's anything to talk about.
Well, I'm glad we
our
did.
Our annual s'mores trip.
We did confirm at the meetup that Connor was not bit by an insect, but had actually probably burned himself.
I signed the papers ahead of time, Josh, when I stepped on your premises, and there will be no suing that my son burned his leg.
Here's the thing I felt really bad about, though.
It's his own fault. Well, it really is.
Also, these are the two kids, him and Quinn, are coming up to me, right? What can we do?
We're bored.
Because we were outside the whole night.
And they're so like, annoying.
Well, they didn't know what to do outside.
No,
like, what do we do out here?
No.
Can we go inside? And I
said,
no. They
need some game console to play or
like,
TV to watch.
We're outside. Find something to do outside. And then what happens?
He gets burned.
He's never stepping outside again. He's like, yeah, outside sucks. I just get hurt. What is Mr. Larson talking about?
Yeah.
So that lesson went over real well. What did I want to ask you if you guys were watching? Oh, Stranger Things. Probably not, right?
No.
Okay. It's only 8 episodes,
I know
though.
It's a phenomenon.
Yeah.
I just got to Making a Murderer. The chances of me getting a Stranger Things, it'll be a year from now.
But it was quick, and Debbie brought it up, actually. She's the one who was like, let's give this a try. I thought it might be a little too much horror for her, but I was intrigued hearing the good word. I got to say, though, Matt and Allison, you know, they were pretty down on it and just said it was basically just recycling a lot of nostalgic 80s tropes. And they're not wrong. It's really shameless in that way. And a little bit inauthentic, I would say, also in the details, like these kids would be listening to certain, you know, I don't think it's – who is it now? It's not Echo and the Bunny Men, but similarly obscure groups at the time as markers to what we should think about these kids, right? And so that seems a little out of place, and the posters they put everywhere for like The Thing, and every image is pulled from something else that we've seen before. We just finished it last night, and I'm trying to think what percentage is absolutely brand new creative material, very small. But I kind of had fun with it the whole time anyway. So I would maybe recommend it just because we're so much in the demographic. I mean, these three boys who, you know, I don't know if you know the story at all, but their friend gets kidnapped and there's all sorts of government shenanigans behind it. There's this multiverse thing going on. The three boys are like, they might be exactly your age in 83, I think it's set, because I think I might have been a little older. And so just to see kids in that milieu doing things you remember is a lot of fun. But overall, it is really shameless in terms of a nostalgia fest.
Okay.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.